Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If the soul of a civilization is to be found in its art, what happens when that art is stolen? Adolf Hitler expected that power, along with a twisted sort of gratitude from his own people, when he ordered his troops to loot or destroy the art of the nations he vanquished. His minions stole hundreds of thousands of works, secreting some away in converted castles, mines, and caves. But he did not count on a small but doggedly determined group of experts on the other side. Robert Etzel's newest book tells their story. It's called The Monuments Men, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History. Robert, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
The need to preserve and protect art was something that was understood even in this country that didn't see battle action except for Pearl Harbor in the early days of the war. Can you talk about some of the first precautions undertaken just to preserve museums and artworks in this country?
Well, I was in New York Friday for the 8th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, and I happened to be living in New York on September 11th. And we had a launch party at the Met, and it was poetic in a sense because 68 years ago, within weeks after the bombings of Pearl Harbor, the great museum directors of the United States walked up those steps at the Met and gathered because they realized the great possibility the United States might be invaded by the Japanese on the West Coast, perhaps bombed by the Nazis on the East Coast. So their initial concern, much has happened after September 11th, was to try and figure out how do we protect our nation's treasures. Within a few weeks, I think it became apparent that these fears were unfounded, that practically speaking, that those things weren't likely to happen. But it occurred to them that the United States was going to have to enter into World War II. And in fighting the war on European soil, the great risk was that the United States might win the war, or the Western Allies win the war, but lose the battle with public opinion over the course of time by destroying all of civilization's great treasures. So the effort was to try and figure out how do we avoid becoming the goats of history in doing that.
So they were called the Monuments Men. That wasn't their official title.
No, it was a group called Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives Section. They never had any unit patches, which is one of the reasons we've never heard of these people. There were only a dozen or so on the ground within a month of the landings in Normandy, and only 60 in Europe by the end of the war, charged with the responsibility of saving all the cultural treasures. And initially, their focus was monuments, buildings, churches, structures, hence the name Monuments Men. It's a somewhat confusing title because there were also women involved.
And they were there initially to make sure that Allied troops didn't unnecessarily attack structures that might have historical and cultural significance.
That's right. They assembled. There was a great support team in the United States, also accomplished people that put together lists of works, list of buildings and structures that they then laid over on aerial maps to provide to bombers to try and avoid targeting these cities or avoid damaging these structures. And when the Monuments Men got on the ground, the initial effort was to try and mitigate damage to those structures. In other words, if a church was partially damaged, to the uninformed observer, especially engineers, they would knock the rest of this thing down and use the materials for roads. Well, these Monuments Men understood while it was damaged, it was fixable. And so they had the ability to go and mark these things out of bound, both to keep them from being further destroyed by well-intentioned troops or from being billeted in by having these troops want to live in these things, especially chateaus, country estates, because they realized this was not the way to win over popular support of the people by forced occupation in their homes.
And when you say on the ground, these guys were in some cases on the front lines or even in advance of Allied troops.
That's right. I mean, there's a number of discoveries that I made in further researching this story, and none surprised me more than the fact that the average age of these people was about 40 years old. These were museum directors, curators, art historians, artists, architects, librarians who volunteered for service. Almost all of them had very accomplished careers. Most had families with kids. They had every reason in the world to not volunteer to go do this, and yet they did because they wanted to make their own contribution as part of the greatest generation in history. So you're absolutely right in that observation. It's a stunning thing to imagine, but these guys wanted to be right there on the front line with the troops and look for the things they knew that should be there. And that's where this greatest treasure hunt began, because in so many of these liberated cities, the great works that should have been in the museums and the churches were gone.
So many people are familiar with the idea that Hitler, in his early career, fancied himself an artist and, in fact, tried to get into art school and was rejected.
That's right. I mean, I think this is another significant discovery on my part, on my understanding of this whole story, and I think it's a grossly missed point by many historians. I think a lot of people, perhaps among historians, they're aware about Hitler's interest in art, but I don't think everyone is fully appreciated, and I certainly hadn't until we dug into this, the full extent of it. I mean, for all of us, we can remember when we were 15, 16, 17 years old, and we thought we were great at something, and we were rejected by someone. Someone told us we weren't good at it, and the sense of humiliation that we felt. I think people that can't get back in that mode have forgotten what it was like to be young. But Hitler was rejected not once but twice by the Art Academy in Vienna, once as an artist and the second time as an architect. He'd actually been encouraged to reapply as an architect, so I think he felt baited in that sense. And he believed most of these jurors were Jews. And, you know, here's a guy that was a bad guy to begin with, and he found himself in the perfect storm of opportunity coming to power in Nazi Germany. The last document Hitler signs before he shoots himself in the bunker on April 30th, 1945, is his last will and testament, which he's dictated. And he has not made specific mention of trying to save the people of Germany or the children of Germany, nor has he made any mention about trying to save the infrastructure. In fact, he's issued this Nero decree stipulating that the infrastructure be gutted and destroyed. But he has made a very specific bequest that the works of art that he, quote, collected in the course of his lifetime go towards this world's greatest museum he intended to build in Linz, his Führer Museum. So, you know, it's pretty simple, I think, for most people to understand. First thing he's doing in his great ambition as a teenager is to be recognized as an artist. Throughout his career, you're familiar with my first book, Rescuing Da Vinci, filled with photographs. We have photographs, thousands of him, curating art shows, collecting works of art, building his art collection. The last thought he has before he shoots himself is his art museum. I think people have not fully appreciated how important art was during World War II.
Yeah, he wanted essentially to make his hometown of Linz, which was sort of a backwater, into the greatest cultural center of Europe, if not the world.
That's right. He was very biased towards Vienna because he felt he'd been rejected in this city. So he not only wanted to create a phoenix, if you will, from a very industrial and not very attractive town of Linz and have it become the cultural capital of Europe and at the same time diminish Vienna's cultural influence.
And significantly, this was really chilling to me. Before he invaded any of the places that he did, he sent spies ahead to catalog what existed in their museums. It wasn't simply about taking over the land and the people. He already had designs on stealing these things.
That's right, Chris. In fact, it wasn't just people. It was many of the curators and museum directors of the German museums. I mean, who better qualified to go into these countries, make lists of works of art that they had targeted for theft? Years before the invasion. So the looting that took place under Hitler's aegis was not incidental to combat, as has happened for thousands and thousands of years, but this is premeditated looting on a scale we've never, ever seen before.
So when these things were removed, how were they hidden away?
Well, initially, really, you have to kind of separate it into two different groups of actions. In the eastern countries, let's start with Krakow, Poland, the great Leonardo da Vinci, Lady with an Ermine, that was one of three big pictures at typically found at the Czartoryski Museum. Hitler's intelligence was so accurate, they didn't even go to the museum to get these pictures. They knew they'd been evacuated and hidden in a country estate. They went directly there. So my point about not understanding the role of or the importance of art during World War II, how much resources, how many people, how many gallons of gasoline, tanks, airplanes were consumed by this theft that were diverted away from prosecution of the war. In that instance, in the eastern instance, there were so many efforts to just destroy their culture, as you mentioned earlier. There were many works of art that, because they were by Slavs or Poles or Jews, they felt these aren't works of art. They're all subhuman. We're going to destroy that. In the West, because they intended to occupy these cities like Paris and live there, they knew where the works of art were. The museums had evacuated these things, seeing the outbreak of war. And the Nazis knew which places that these various works had been hidden by the museum directors and curators. They weren't in quite as big a hurry to relocate those things because they realized it was going to cause a great deal of unrest with the populace that they were trying to still gather control.
At what point did the focus shift for the Monuments Men from protecting the structures to actually hunting down these things that have been secreted away?
That's a great question. You know, when they got to Europe, I don't think anybody, even the most informed of the Monuments Men, had any idea of the degree of theft. I mean, I'm sure that they anticipated there was going to be a certain amount of it. But the original focus, Monuments, Fine Arts and Archives, MFAA is sometimes how we refer to it, was building structures and that kind of thing. If something was damaged, try and mitigate the damage. It wasn't to completely repair it, just try and arrest it and prevent it from getting worse. But as they got into Amsterdam, as they got into Bruges, into some of these other cities, the churches had been emptied. And as they started asking people, where are these things, over and over again, they would hear, last time we saw them, they were on Nazi trucks headed east. So it kicked off this effort to try and play a game of ping pong, if you will, trying to track down who has any pieces of information that we can assemble and try and figure out where are these things hidden. So by this time, we're talking about the fall of 1944. It's before the Battle of the Bulge. And it's really an astonishing thing. You consider in September of 44, the Allies have firmly landed in Normandy. They have control over large portions of France. They're into Holland. And the Nazis aren't fleeing for their lives. They're still stealing. They go and get the Bruges Madonna by Michelangelo in September 44.
This was in the Church of Our Lady.
It was in the church, yeah.
Yeah, we should remind people that in Europe, it's not uncommon to have these masterworks in churches that are even not in wartime or in wartime sort of left unlocked.
That's right. Yeah, if you go to Ghent, Belgium, you'll see the Van Eyck Ghent altarpiece, which is probably the most important work of art that was stolen during the war. It's a massive altarpiece, 20 feet high, maybe 30 feet wide, and a series of panels that I can tell you from having visited recently is very firmly bolted into the ground now. But these things were literally not only picked up and packed off, but a lot of times the support structures were. The Vite Staats altarpiece in Krakow was stolen. And as an afterthought, the Nazis realized they needed the metal structure that supported the whole thing and had to go back and steal that.
And then they were placed into, I guess, at first very carefully chosen sites. And then the Nazis got more desperate as times went on.
They absolutely were desperate. Hitler considered discussion by some of the museum people there of evacuating Germany's own treasures. Now the problems become greatly exacerbated. Okay. We not only have all these stolen works of art, and yeah, I should interject here, we talk about paintings all the time, sculpture sometimes, but imagine millions of library books, all of the bells from the churches throughout Europe, more than 5,000 church bells that were found in shipyards that were going to be melted down, stained glass from cathedrals throughout Europe. The list of things that they stole is as long as the variety of things. And so different hiding places had different things, thousands of Torah scrolls, tapestries, and so on. In the closing days of the war, in March 1945, the German museum directors were making appeals to Hitler about the bombing was so severe in Germany that they were at risk of having Germany's own museum treasures destroyed. And they'd been pleading for months to evacuate these things. And I'm convinced that in March 45, when they did start to move them, they just disregarded his orders not to do it and started getting them out of there. But they're moving many of these great paintings from the German museums, the Kaiser Friedrich Museum, on the back of open trucks at night to try and avoid the daylight bombing raids, over rickety roads, oftentimes not paved, to get them into salt mines, copper mines, horrible conditions, many times not even crated. Pretty extraordinary scenario.
Robert Edsel is my guest. His newest book is called The Monuments Men, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
thief among the high Nazis was Hermann Göring, who looted museums and private collections in all parts of Europe. Much was hidden in caves, and advancing troops captured fully laden freight cars, ready to move much of the collection to safer places for Hermann. Göring's ill-gotten loot is no longer his to admire. The collection goes on display for GIs before an Allied commission attempts to return everything to the proper owners. The Castle of Neuschwanstein, overlooking Fussen, housed a great part of the art treasures stolen by the Nazis. Taken from royal families, the Rothschilds, and private French collectors, many of the 23,000 pieces were never unpacked. Not content with robbing people of their freedom and their lives, the Nazis tried to make off with their symbols of culture. Among the criminals rounded up is Field Marshal von Rundstedt. His arrogance subdued, but not much, as he's taken into custody. The typically Prussian professional soldier is captured along with his son. It was von Rundstedt who was picked by Hitler to stem the Allied tide in France. Another prize is Field Marshal Kesselring, who was smashed with his armies in Italy. He doesn't seem downcast, yet. He'll stand trial, and that goes for Göring, too. The number two Nazi has the blood of thousands on his hands, and for that he will have to answer. He wears few of his prized medals, as he's taken to headquarters for preliminary questioning by 7th Army officers and to surrender his arms. Members of the American and British press are present to interview the former head of the Luftwaffe. And, you guessed it, he blames everything on his old pal, Hitler.
That is authentic period newsreel footage of some of the coverage of the work of the Monuments Men. With us this hour is Robert Edsel, whose new book is called The Monuments Men, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History. Were a lot of people in this country aware of the work that was going on? It was such a small team.
Yes, and unfortunately, their great accomplishments were lost in the fog of history. When most of the millions of troops came home in 1945-46, the monuments officers' work really had just begun, because in the closing days of the war, and we chronicle this in Monuments Men, using their letters home to their spouses, letters no one's ever seen before. In fact, some of the families argued with me, saying, "We don't have those things." And I would tell them, "I'm quite certain you do. You just haven't looked enough yet." But these letters, oftentimes written on the back of a painting that they've turned over while they're in one of these salt mines during the long periods of boredom packing these things, really extraordinary scenes that we see over and over again in the telling of it. So I think to find these things, they, in the closing days of the war, in more than 1,000 hiding places, salt mines and castles filled with these works of art, books, etc., that they then had to figure out, what do you do when you find the equivalent of the Met or the Dallas Museum of Art's contents in a salt mine, in a remote area with no roads, no vehicles, war-torn area. And so it occurred to them to create some central collecting points where they could bring everything and have security, and in the process basically set up museums far larger than the Metropolitan Museum of Art overnight. And they needed packers and shippers and photographers and researchers to try and go through and figure out, what is this stuff? Where did it come from? How do we go about getting it back? And they stayed in Europe until 1951, restituting these works of art. They ultimately returned more than 5 million objects to countries that had been robbed.
How many things never found an owner or a descendant or someone left to claim what had been stolen?
Well, I think there are two categories, really, we should talk about. One are works of art that were restituted to countries. The way this process worked, the Army didn't want to be in this business in the first place. This was an experiment, really. It was the first time in history an Army had fought a war on the one hand and mitigate damage to cultural treasures at the same time. And the Monuments Men were the instruments of this policy. No one could have foreseen the degree of theft that took place at the outset. So they were entirely unprepared for, what do you do when you find this situation? Well, the Army wanted out of it, and they didn't want to get involved in arbitrating this. So the policy was to return these things to the countries from which they were stolen and liaise with officials there and leave it up to those countries to get them back to the individual owners. Well, we know today. Some countries made a significant effort to try and find the owners. Some countries, Austria would be an example, were opportunistic and did not pursue trying to track everyone down. Of course, it was very difficult because so many people had been killed during the war, millions of Jews. Their records, documents were not there to try and identify these things. So we have one category of works of art that have been returned that still haven't found owners. The owners may be out there, but they have obligations on them to try and go and look through these databases to see if there's anything online that they can identify as theirs. And then the other category, which is a really fascinating group, which are the hundreds of thousands of works of art, millions of documents, musical manuscripts, library books, and other things that are still missing. And I think it's a folly of thought to imagine that they're all destroyed. And I believe we'll have a front row seat over the next 5 to 10 years as the World War II generation passes to see more and more of these things surface. And it's going to be a very exciting time to understand the role the Monuments Men had, because they were really the first, if you will, detectives on the scene. And it's their records and their documents everyone always goes back to, because they were the first people there to document it.
Let's talk for a minute. There were close to 90, at least this is an estimate, catalogs created for Hitler of these things that had been stolen. And there was sort of characteristic Nazi obsession with making sure that everything was notated. For a while, it was believed there were only 39 of them left in existence.
That's right. They're called ERR albums, Einsatzstab Reichsleiter Rosenberg, and it was named after Alfred Rosenberg, who was one of the chief defendants at the Nuremberg trials, and he was executed along with many of the other Nazi defendants. And during the portion of the trials at Nuremberg that pertained to art theft, it was a small portion of the trials. Obviously, the focus were on the number of people that had been killed and the apparatus. There were 39 albums that were introduced into evidence, and they were the chief prosecution evidence in this portion of the trial. And they were albums of photographs of works of art that had been stolen by the Nazis. As these items were stolen, and they would pass through the Jeu de Paume Museum in Paris, where one of the heroines in our book, in fact, in my view, probably the greatest woman hero of World War II, Rose Vallon, who was a French monuments officer, tracked and kept record. She would duplicate at the risk of her life every night, go home and make notes of the paintings that she'd seen and take some of these Nazi documents and duplicate them.
And she was this very unassuming person that no one suspected for a moment.
And on top of that, she understood German, and the Germans obviously didn't know that. And at the end of the war, Rose had an incredibly life-changing decision to make, and that was, did she turn this information over to her French compatriots, or did she give them to the person who she believed was going to be the first person in Germany to make use of the information? And that was a decision she made, and the person to whom she gave them was American Monuments man Jim Rorimer, who's on the front cover of our book, standing there on the castle of the steps of Neuschwanstein with a little notepad, making a record of the paintings that are being carried out by other Monuments Men from the castle. And this castle was found because it was the key repository Rose Vallon had identified, and she had entrusted this information to him. And I think one of the reasons she was overlooked by history, and in some cases in France was looked at somewhat as a traitor, is that she provided this information to an American, not her French compatriots.
Robert Edsel is my guest. His new book is called The Monuments Men, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Thanks for the great show. A couple of comments. I was struck in the first 5 minutes of the conversation before we really got much deeper into the group of people who were doing the reconnection with the artworks, of how you could pretty much just kind of insert Iraq into some of that stuff. And I realized that some of the parallels aren't gonna connect up. I find it very interesting that one of the results of the invasion and subsequent occupation was the loss of a lot of very, very important works of art for that region, and consequently, of course, for the world. And I just wonder, what your guest feels like in terms of that loss and those losses, and whether something along the lines of the group of people that worked during World War II, if we had something like that could go into that country and start to perhaps track down some of these pieces of art that may have been lost or damaged, that it may in some way perhaps help the cause in some certain way. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Tim, for that excellent question. And it's truly one of those duh moments. It's a question that I'm asked at all my lectures, and I do address it in the conclusion of Monuments Men. But in short, The monuments men during World War II set the standard for how to protect cultural treasures in times of combat. And the important part was the fact that this was a policy endorsed by President Roosevelt. Orders were issued by General Eisenhower, field-wide orders, twice, once before the invasion in Sicily and again prior to the invasion of Normandy, that they would make an effort to protect cultural treasures so much as war allowed. There are cultural officers. There were cultural officers in Iraq. They were civil affairs officers. I know several of them, really accomplished people, brilliant people. And they and many other people advised the administration prior to the invasion of Iraq, if we go over there, we have to make sure we demonstrate that we're going to care for these things. And unfortunately, it fell on deaf ears by the time it got to the very, very highest levels. And the United States was thrust in a position of reacting to the aftermath of the looting. And, you know, our parents were right. First impressions do matter. And unfortunately, the first impression we created in the Islamic world was Americans don't care about Islamic treasures. We don't understand what they're like. We're very European-centric and only care about that. And for all the good work that was done since then, identifying the 15,000 things that were stolen, about half of which have been located and returned, and great efforts to help get the museums reopened, that story gets lost because what everyone remembers is what happened at the beginning. American soldiers standing there watching the looting. Because you have to understand, soldiers are not entrepreneurs. They wait for orders. The orders have to come from superior officers, and they come from the top. So what we know from the Monuments Men experience in World War II is this. The policy has to be set at the top, and it is a top-down-driven strategy. And when that happens, you can put great heroes like the Monuments Men from World War II out there, and you cannot give them vehicles and let them hitchhike, as they did. You cannot give them field radios, as they did, and they'll find some way still to get the job done. But you have to empower them from the top down, and that's what didn't happen in Iraq.
Robert Edsel is my guest. His new book is called The Monuments Men. Let's go back to the phone now and speak with Jason in Weatherford. Hey, Jason.
Hi. Great show. Mr. Edsel, I had a couple of questions. The first one is, do you think that Hitler's pure love for art was the reason that he collected all of those things, or is there a congruence between the historical conquests for, valuable things, the Romans and stuff like that? And my other question is, what do you have to say about the irony that maybe some of those works of art were protected by the Germans, which may have led to them actually making it through the war instead of being firebombed and destroyed during the war?
Good questions. I think as to the former, art's always been a key target for conquering nations. Oftentimes in the past, that's how they paid their soldiers. They were spoils of war. But this was very different because laws were passed by the Nazis in these countries to legalize what they were going about doing. They were attempting to hide it in the paper hanging process that they went through and make it into something very, very different than it was in the past. They knew what they were doing. I think Hitler really saw himself as this great creator. And unfortunately, I think his capacity to create involved destroying things. I mean, we constantly hear about him rebuilding cities, his hometown of Linz, wanting to rebuild Berlin. And he would go and see these ancient cities. Rome impressed him greatly. Florence, he felt he was an artist walking among artists when he went to the Uffizi Museum and saw all these great paintings. So I think he genuinely believed he had this artistic talent and ability. A number of his watercolors survived from his pre-war years. They're pedestrian in nature, but they have some ability. And so in any event, I think he was trying to recast what was good art and what was bad. He viewed these works by the beloved Impressionists and modern painters as degenerate and ordered that they be removed from German museums and destroyed. Art was a weapon of propaganda. It was a hugely important tool in the Nazi Party. As to your second question, which was?
The question about whether, ironically, the Germans right. spiriting these things away allowed them to be protected during other bombing runs.
I don't think there's any doubt that many of these things placed in these salt mines, while they suffered to some degree from the storage conditions, most of these salt mines were impregnable to bombing, so they were certainly safer in that respect. And I think certainly when you go to museums, one has to marvel about how many of these things did survive. But there were some horrific losses. I mean, the Eritramani Chapel in Italy that was destroyed, that had these fresco cycles by Mantegna, other works of art. The Last Supper was almost destroyed by Allied bombing. There were an enormous number of losses and close calls, and then a number of paintings that I'm sure, while I do believe there'll be tens of thousands of these works of art surface, as well as documents, there's no doubt that many of them are also destroyed, and they're on lists for a reason. So it's tough to compliment the Nazis for going about their theft as anything that was contributing towards the preservation of these paintings, but I think de facto in some cases it probably did help.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. Okay, take us back here for just a second. It's the middle of the war, and I can imagine these monuments men sitting around a table trying to decide how to preserve all these cultural artifacts. Okay, I can imagine sort of a Sophie's Choice scenario for these people about how much of these Rembrandts are they worth much more than this group of Tiepolos, or how exactly does that work? Is you got to figure that they had a hierarchy of things that were more important to them. Take us into the process a little bit. I'm very curious about that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
I think it's an interesting question. And boy, I tell you, I love to make a living out of trying to give credit to these guys, but I think we're probably overreaching a little bit there. You know, they're just trying to get by. You consider, and we discuss this in Monuments Men, the first meeting they had in the field after the landings in Normandy. Several of them hitchhiked their way there. A couple of them didn't make the meeting because there were no field telephones to let them know that there was going to be a meeting. And then the fellow whose brainchild this thing really was, a guy named George Stout, who was a conservator of works of art at the Fogg Museum in Harvard, a guy who was 46 years old at the beginning of World War II. He'd fought in World War I. Comes driving up in a German Volkswagen that they'd confiscated. So that was really the first meeting they had, and I think was typical of the improvisation that they were constantly faced with in trying to figure out how exactly do we go about doing our job now that we're here.
Robert Edsel is my guest. His newest book is called The Monuments Men, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. Robert Edsel is my guest. His new book is called The Monuments Men, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History. One of the restrictions on the Monuments Men was that their activity was not to interfere with military objectives. How easy was it to do both at the same time?
I think at the outset it was very, very difficult. While I applaud tremendously President Roosevelt and in particular General Eisenhower's orders in support of the Monuments Men, the creation of them, at the same point in time when the rubber meets the road and these guys are out there in the field, they're finding themselves literally hitchhiking from place to place because they don't have field vehicles. Before our break, we talked about George Stout, who had a form of transportation. He confiscated a German Volkswagen command car that had no top to it, a loose steering wheel, et cetera, but this is how he managed to get around. No field telephones, no typewriters, no cameras. Months later, they got cameras, but no film. So this is how it went. And I think perhaps to 20-year-olds, this would have been an insurmountable obstacle. But to these 40-year-olds that had been thrust in job situations without resources, they just figured, well, at least we're here. Now that we're here, we can actually do something about this. And they got resourceful. They figured out ways to improvise and overcome the problems over and over and over again. In fact, one great example we talk about in the book, they had these out-of-bounds signs that they could post on buildings to try and keep troops from billeting in them. But that started to wear off after a while when the troops realized there wasn't anybody there to supervise the buildings after these monuments men had moved on. So George Stout said, well, we have a solution for that. And they got white mining tape that the engineers used to mark landmines. And they would wrap those around the buildings.
So no one's going in.
They found that those were very effective solutions.
Well, you know, Robert, even to think about museum standards for moving a painting within a building, much less packing it up across the country, are so exacting. And they also had to sort of follow those as closely as they could, but relax a little and allow things to be moved in really unorthodox ways.
That's a great point, Chris. In fact, I hope we never find out, but I don't think museums today could possibly accomplish what some of these monuments men had to do back then under entirely different circumstances. I mean, evacuating a museum the size of the Louvre in a 10-day period, I mean, it's an astonishing thought. But war does strange things, and one of the things it does is suspend the normal rules, and you have kind of a process of triage and how you go about doing things. So these monuments men would sometimes find paintings that were on canvas weaves lying on the floor of a salt mine, and sometimes there'd be standing water there, and there would be moss growing through the canvas like a chia pet, if you will. And we're not talking about crummy paintings. We're talking about paintings by Van Gogh is one specific example that they wrote about. Other panels that had been used, wooden panels, paintings that had been used for where knives had been stabbed into them, almost like they'd been throwing knives at them because they were like a dartboard, if you will. So extraordinary situations. And then when these monuments men start finding these things in the salt mines and caves, I've been to some of these salt mines and walked through them. They're about shoulder width. Some places you can't completely stand up. 40 to 45 degrees, constant temperature, very, very cold when you're in them for hours and hours. Some go back laterally more than a mile and a half back into the ground. And you find things like the Bruges Madonna by Michelangelo, a sculpture that weighs 2 tons, that's about life size. You find oversized paintings. Frankly, when you start to read about it, you wonder how in the heck the Nazis ever even got these things in the salt mines. And then, of course, how are the monuments men going to get them out? And when you do, how do you pack them? You don't have any materials. It's wartime. So it really is a testament to their ingenuity on how they came up with the ability to remove these things and then safely get them to places where they could evaluate them and ultimately return them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ken in Arlington. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Great show, and thanks for the comments on the Iraqi treasures and the information. My question is, what do we know about the Nazi thefts that may have been hidden in the Russian sector?
That's a good question. Let's talk about what we know that is public knowledge. If you go to the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg or you go to the Pushkin Museum in Moscow, both have rooms. In Petersburg, they call it Hidden Treasures Revealed, and there are an extraordinary array of Impressionist pictures that were taken by Red Army soldiers from the eastern portions of Germany, looted, if you will. But there was a debate at the end of the war with Stalin and the leaders at Potsdam about whether there would be restitution in kind. This is a different thought than the Western Allied powers, who were determined to just return these works of art. And it's a real demarcation in civilization's history because it's the first time after a war that the victors stood up and announced that the policy was to the victors do not belong the spoils of war. These things should go back to the countries from which they were stolen. So it's created a debate that rages on today about the legality and the ethical aspect of Russia keeping these works of art that were taken from Germany. These are the ones that we know about. I'm sure that there are many of the missing works can be found in some of the eastern countries. But one has to understand there's a massive asterisk here. 25 million Russians killed during World War II. 25 million. 17.5 million civilians, 7.5 million soldiers. If you look at the United States military history and add up all the wars this country's ever fought, you're at about 1.2 million of casualties off soldiers. So it's hard in Russia to discuss this subject. It's especially hard when non-Russians or non-Germans are injecting their opinions about what should or shouldn't happen. And I think it's a dispute that will take more generations passing, allowing the sting of these losses, which is still very, very an open wound there to calm down.
The process is still also ongoing of museums going through their personal collections that they don't necessarily understand to have been stolen and returning works when it's found to be appropriate to the rightful owner.
Well, that's right. That's a great point, Chris. And in fact, that's an ongoing process with an uneven record. Some museums, what you're referring to is the American Association of Museums has created guidelines that they want all museums and private collectors as well to know where your works of art were from 1932 to 1946. It's a period in the trade they refer to as the gap period. And if you had a painting that was painted in the United States, you need not worry about that. If you have a painting that was a European painting or it was in Europe in 1931 and appears in the United States in 1950, you should be making some effort to identify where that thing was in between because it may be something that was stolen. In the United States, we respect theft, and that is to say that once a theft, always a theft. No amount of passage of time is going to change the nature of a crime. In Europe, it's not necessarily the same way. The laws vary from country to country, but they tend to take a look at things with a statute of limitations and that someone could be a good faith purchaser. We don't look at this in that manner. So it's a complicated arena, but there are many museums that are making a conscientious effort to go through their collections, either works of art that they've bought or works that they've received by donation, not something that they acquired per se, but they received, to determine where these works of art. And then they're supposed to go on their websites and post any works of art that came into the museum during that time period so that someone who was robbed during the war can go onto these various museum sites and see if there are any things missing from their family that might be able to be identified. There are some museums that are not trying as hard as they should. There's some museums that plead poverty, some that drag their feet, some that aren't members of American Association of Museums and feel like those guidelines don't necessarily pertain to them. I think that's utter nonsense, of course. I think it's just a matter of it's very simple in my view. Sometimes people ask about things that are missing, valuable works of art. Look, if your great-grandfather gave something to your grandfather and he gave it to your father who intended for you to have it so you could give it to your son, it doesn't matter what the commercial value of it is. For your family, for your purposes, it's priceless. And I think that the effort is to try and compel people to do the right thing, which is determine what these things are. And if we can make it easier on people that have been victims of this greatest theft in history to identify things that were stolen, then we should do that.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Miranda in Dallas. Hi, Miranda.
Hi. I have a couple of questions, and thank you for the wonderful program, by the way.
Sure.
One is are there any plans to sort of honor the monuments of men and women, maybe in the Smithsonian or something, have their own section of the kind of the chronicles that they have collected, these letters, maybe pictures of them, and sort of call more attention to the work that they've done? And also, are there any plans for this book of yours becoming a screenplay? Because I think it would sounds like it would be something that the public would be very interested in.
Bless you for your wise observations on both counts. Let me address the screenplay. I've had contacts from people. There's probably no single question I'm asked more consistently, usually as the first question when I lecture, than why in the world haven't they made a film of this? I can only say that I think, one, it's an epic story that takes place over a 6 or 7 year period, over a vast geographic scope. And I think I really truly believe it's the greatest untold story of World War II. And that's saying a lot here in the 70th anniversary of the beginning of World War II, that a story of this magnitude could have been unknown, overlooked by historians, et cetera, that had tremendous repercussions to it. So we're glad to tell the story. And I think part of the delay here is people just trying to get their arms around what the heck is this thing, how big is it, and then how do we go about telling it. I think the biggest missing ingredient has been the people story. At the end of the day, I mean, Rescuing Da Vinci, while I'm quite proud of it, it was an effort to tell the story using photographs, but it's more a dry telling of it, looking at some amazing photographs, but you can't connect with any people in that. You can in Monuments Men. That's what it's about. We pick 9 men, 1 woman who are in a race against time, who have 11 months to hunt down the greatest works of art and beloved cultural treasures in the world before Nazi fanatics attempt to destroy it. that's a pretty fascinating scenario for film, and I'm confident that it's going to happen. But I'm also got a tremendous commitment to these men and women. I've interviewed all 15 living Monuments men that we found. There are since six who have died. There are nine still living, eight men, one woman. I've interviewed every family member I ever come across. So my commitment is not just to see it done and check it off the list. It's to see it done right. And that then narrows the field of the people that I would be interested in seeing make the film. With respect to your other question, this is something that's always on the foremost of my mind. These letters are amazing. There are a number of different programs out there, Veterans History Program, that does oral and taped recordings of veterans. They've never even heard who the Monuments Men are. That's how untold the story is. They've interviewed hundreds of thousands of vets. They never even heard of the Monuments Men to go do it. We've made sure I filmed all the interviews. We tape recordings. I don't know how many photographs we've got, uniforms, other artifacts. So it is my desire to see that happen. Another desire is to have hopefully the public identify and come forward other Monuments Men we don't know about, provide photographs that we don't know about. This is a huge part of World War II that the story and final chapters are not written, and part of the idea of writing Monuments Men was not just to tell an adventure story, and I frankly consider a love story with these guys' letters home to their spouses, but also to engage the public to help us gather the information we don't have, because it's out there. We're going to find more of these albums Chris referred to earlier, these Hitler albums we found two of and donated to the National Archives.
You say we, you mean your team specifically?
Yeah, our team. There were two Hitler albums that were found. I call these Hitler albums because they were found in Hitler's home in Berchtesgaden. And he'd been flipping through these things, looking at the photographs of works of art, trying to decide which ones he wanted to have for his own collection. And these are two exactly like the 39 that were used at Nuremberg during the trial. And so that leaves 50 to 60 more albums that are out there somewhere. I'm sure some might have been destroyed, but I'm quite certain other GIs like the GI that picked up these two, these sat in someone's attic for 60 some odd years before his nephew came forward and said, you know, I've got these things. I'm not sure what they are. Can you help me with them? And it took months to identify what they were. But ultimately, the place those belonged was the National Archives, and our MonumentsMenFoundation.org donated those. And so that's part of the role, is to finish the work of the Monuments Men.
We have such a short time left, but I think what fascinates me about the whole story is that we think we've heard about all the savagery of World War II, but this little bit of humanity is such an interesting foil to all that horror. And you also recognize how important this is, even as compared with human lives.
Well, I think it really is. And one of the things that was an eternal conundrum for the Monuments Men is art worth a life? And, you know, I have a son who's 16 years old, and in 2 years he'd be eligible for military. I mean, the thought of having him tell me he wanted to go into combat to try and save a painting on the one hand would be a horrifying thought to me, as it would be any parent. On the other hand, if we think about placing the lives of troops at risk to save a country's culture, there I think it becomes something that's hugely valuable, because at the end of the day, these things provide us with enormous satisfaction and happiness. And they're an important part of who we are as a civilization. They chronicle that, and it would be a horrifying thing to lose it.
Robert Edsel's new book, written with Brett Witter, is called The Monuments Men, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History. Robert, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much
Thank
for joining
you, Chris.
Us. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.